So good evening, everybody. I am going to talk about something fairly traditional and considered a core element of Buddhist practice. And it's in the context of this text that I put together to support lay practice for folks. The Elixir of Bodhicitta is what we're calling it. And there's a section of refuge. I'm actually going to put that section in the chat for those who are interested and don't have this text. And so refuge is a very traditional part of Buddhist practice. And for those who are new to my style of teaching, I sort of am someone who's always struggling internally between being almost a fundamentalist, traditionalist, and completely rebels against that part of myself. And I hope something fruitful emerges out of that tension. First, before we go into refuge, this important part of Buddhist practice, I want to presence the massive vulnerability of almost all human beings that there is a part of us that is not knowing what life is about. 50s, 60s, 70s, doesn't matter. There's a part of us that's not knowing if we're good. Not sure if we're living the good life, even if we've been following a recipe for a very long time. There's part of us not knowing if we're doing the right thing with our lives. That vulnerability. And some would say maybe the deepest vulnerability that I want to name is we don't know what happens after death. That may be really important. Maybe not. It actually depends on what you currently believe, whether that's important or not. That's a massive vulnerability. What if you just end up in some perpetual Walmart with endless aisles? Okay, so this refuge verse says, I take refuge in this very mind and moment. As the indivisible three kayas, open purity, untamable playful energy, and all suffusing natural presence. So I'm going to talk about three levels of refuge. This is a somewhat traditional scheme in the Mahayana for understanding refuge. And the three levels are outer, inner, and the third is sometimes called secret or oneness or indestructible. It really just depends on the context. So refuge, I think refuge is a religious concept here. The idea is that it's an invitation to step out of ways of being, ways of thinking, ways of relating, sometimes groups of people that reinforce our confusion about the genuine causes of happiness. That's another traditional saying, the genuine causes of happiness. And Dharma teachings say human beings are actually confused about the genuine causes of happiness. How do you know? You look around. How do you know? You turn on the news. So, refuge in the context of Buddhism, something that may not be actualized, but at least it's said, is that the Dharma is a raft. that it is a, the point is not for you to be a Buddhist. The point is for you and I to get free. We love clubs and we have a need for belonging, and people tend to identify with anything they possibly can that seems cool or suitable or has benefits. But refuge is taking refuge in Dharma, as in the metaphor the Buddha used and other teachers, is it's a raft. It's a boat to get from the place we're currently in. The hypothesis is we're in a place of suffering, of not being free, of not knowing our true nature, and arrive at a place that is free of that suffering, of knowing our true nature. So refuge is not a should, it's an inquiry. What vision of reality do we invest in? What response to suffering are we taking to this vulnerability of not knowing what life is, where we're going, what the best thing to do is? And refuge is also something that we're working with. We are feeling out the degree to which we refuge. How fully do we wish to plunge into the transformative methods of the Dharma? That depends on a lot of things. Some people have real inborn faith. It comes really easily. Some people have a lot of skepticism. One person is not necessarily better than the other. Each situation can have its challenges. At its best, or in its healthy situation, a lineage of contemplative practice is a complete culture of transformation. You step into it and it's acting on your body, speech, and mind to liberate you, to free you from wrong view, from wrong relationship with reality, from habits that cause suffering. The idea is that you're taking refuge in a transformative matrix. That if a lineage is healthy, it will cook you and you'll come out tasty. So let me start with the outer refuge. And you know, what's interesting is some people, for example, might have some outer refuge and not really connect with the inner or the indestructible. Or some people may have indestructible, but totally, at least for now, have more problems with the outer. And that's okay. These are different dimensions of it. So the refuges, traditionally called the three refuges, are Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And Buddha means, for the outer refuge, awakened one. And so here, we are taking refuge in the traditions of Buddhism as coming from somebody who we feel had some kind of penetrating insight into human happiness. This person did very similar practices to the ones we're doing, and it led to release from the prison of the mind. It led to a full release of the heart. Yeah. for someone who has deep faith in the historical Buddha, this person was fully liberated. That's what it would mean. It would mean that the Buddha uprooted suffering altogether. And it's not the suffering of like, I can't get a Frappuccino. Not that suffering. It's full freedom from being identified with the limitations of body-mind. We could say it lots of ways. We could say the Buddha is someone who all obstacles to love fell away, all obstacles to compassion completely eradicated. Right. So outer refuge is we're beginning with some faith in the historical Buddha's insights and the successive teachers. That seems kind of important. After all, this tradition did start with somebody who had this great integrity of practice, or even if we think of successive generations, maybe even 100, 200 years ago, we have faith that those people practiced with really great integrity. And they're reporting from the other shore. They're saying, I did some version of what you're doing with all my heart. It took me here. And you are not an exception. I too was on the same shore you are currently on. You can come to this shore where there is no suffering, where there is no limitation to love and wisdom. If we have a skeptical mind, it's not so easy to swallow something like that. How do I know there even was a Buddha? The skeptical mind says, how do I know this wasn't all just made up to sell books? How do I know all these people don't just want a free meal? You know, something interesting is we never, and I could be wrong about this, but I believe that we never ever experience someone else's interior. That human life means we are utterly and completely wedded to our own interior. You never can fully know what someone else's state of mind is. So the skeptic says, I don't, awakened? What is that? I don't know. But it may be that their words resonate something in us. Or doing their practice that was passed down resonates something in us. And so we're like, okay, I can go with this. Maybe there was this fully enlightened person. The outer Buddha may be somebody we meet. We may meet a teacher that resonates something in us. That someone is irritating us, and that same person doesn't irritate them. And that seems consistent. We think something's a little bit different. Something might have happened. We feel there's some evidence of transformation. I don't know if it was different in the past. In other countries, cultures with Buddhism. But our skepticism is complicated by this that I take to be true. We cannot know what we don't know. And further, you can never exhaust that which you don't know. It always remains that which you don't know. And so we can have as much skepticism as we want, but we actually don't know and can't know until we arrive where this practice goes. This is part of taking refuge. We say, okay, Maybe the Buddha didn't just want to sell books and get a free meal. Maybe there's something else to it. Because I can't yet know what I don't know. In the Zen tradition, we really celebrate this, the profundity of not knowing. We say, not knowing is most intimate. The closer we stay to that knowing, the more possibility for discovery spiritually. I don't yet know what I don't know. I love that. And I'll never know what I don't know. It will perpetually be so. Interesting. So the second refuge is the Dharma, and that is the teachings that came from the Buddha and the descendants. And as we know, as modern people, are we modern people? Are we postmodern people? Are we post-postmodern people? The Dharma has branched off in many, many ways. It wasn't all that long ago that different traditions were siloed, and they actually didn't really encounter each other. For example, Southeast Asian Buddhists tend to think Vajrayana Tibetan Buddhism is just like devil worship because they've never really encountered the teachings. The countries were isolated. But we can see that it branched off, and there's all kinds of teachings. And refuge in Dharma means we're going to take those teachings to heart. I'm going to commit to applying those methods. And as an extension of what I was saying about not knowing what we don't know, to take that further is to say we don't actually know what gets cooked unless we put the ingredients together. That's another thing. That's another tricky thing for the skeptical mind, and especially for the modern shopping mind that says, I'll take a little bit of Zazen, but no bowing, please. Hold the bowing. I'm bowing free. Bowing gives me indigestion. I'll take the mantras, but please hold the lamas. I have a teacher allergy. I break out in hives. That's a very postmodern situation. We could go into the reasons why we have mistrust of authority. I think it makes sense that people mistrust authority. I think there's some wisdom in mistrusting authority, but how, to what degree? Well, in this case, hopefully no one's telling you what you are supposed to do, but they're presenting you with a recipe. And they've been long cooked is the thing. This is the thing about a lineage. A lineage is people with the same intention over centuries refining, like, how can we best do this? So we have the cultural translation, which is its own challenge, granted. But a tradition like Zen for, I don't know, it's like 1400 years or something, 1200 years, the recipe has been refined. It's like if your grandmother has like the best borscht recipe because it came down for generations, well, just think of Zen Buddhism. It's been cooking for a real long time. May not be your flavor. So that's part of what refuge in Dharma means. And last thing I want to say about lineage here is each system has its integrity. It has its, it all works together. So when we pick and choose, it's problematic if we don't like certain ingredients that are the ones we actually need. And how do we know? This is tricky. Yeah. Okay. So that's Dharma, basically the teachings of those who have come to some degree of awakening. Then we have the outer level of the Sangha, which means community. This is interesting. I don't know enough as I should about other religious systems, but the Buddha's emphasis on relationship is really actually quite interesting. If you look at the original monastic guidelines, a lot of it revolves around making sure practitioners do not step out of ongoing relationship with each other. And this is true of most of the Buddhist traditions and very true of Zen. There's an emphasis that if you don't practice with other people, you tend to kid yourself. And so we chant something like practicing amidst the Sangha, which verify our understanding. So Sangha is engagement and commitment with groups of folks who have refuge in Buddha and Dharma and also have refuge in Sangha. The traditional fourfold Sangha was nuns, monks, lay women, lay men. And then actually in Asia, there were different classes of practitioners. There were hermit practitioners, there were yogi practitioners that were somewhere in between. But anyway, so part of the transformative soup, the recipe, is hanging out with other people who do the practice. It was not considered dispensable. We're in this experiment. We don't know if it will work online. Right. At this point, like some people I've never seen in 3D, I'm not sure you're real. You could be a deep fake. I could be a deep fake for all you, some of you know. There is like a Suzuki Roshi, like artificial intelligence robot now. You could go on that website. I might not be real. And some people, we've been in this maybe not real situation for like 3 years now. Does it actually work? Does it have the intended effect of what Sangha is supposed to do? It's an experiment. The thing about Sangha that I don't think anybody really likes is it's partially you need to be exposed. We need to be seen in our humanity, in our foibles, and in our clarity. We need to be seen because we can't completely see ourselves. It's like, have you ever thought about, I often say this, but how you can't actually see your own face in the mirror without some sort of presentation? Like there's a mirror face. Think about it. You have whatever face you do, and then you look and you're like, you're trying to see how you look, but because you're trying to see how you look, you make a face. Sangha, and this includes a teacher, is one of the most valuable ways to see how we look. So that's the outer form of Sangha. The inner Buddha, refuge. You have Buddha nature. You have Buddha nature. Our tradition emphasizes that the only difference between the Buddha and us is deeply recognizing or not recognizing our true nature. That's the only difference. It's a very radical statement. The only difference between the awakened ones and an ordinary person is recognizing or not recognizing the reality of mind. The inner refuge of Buddha is a profoundly positive statement. It's profoundly positive. It's profoundly life-giving. That each of our nature is this, it's really inarticulable, but we could say words like sacred, perfect, complete, unbounded. And all of the confusion, and even the most extreme confusion that we would look out usually at someone else and say, that person is really confused. They're really twisted up. Their Buddha nature is not twisted up. It's still pristinely there. It just, if there's the inaction of greed, anger, and ignorance, it's just not recognized. So we have Buddha nature, is the inner Buddha refuge. And what do we do with that knowledge? Depends partially on how much faith we have in it. How do we respond to that? It impacts how we practice. If you are sitting down and doing your meditation, believing that ultimately you're a little suffering, confused, irredeemable being, that's wrong view. That's not taking refuge on this level. All of that stuff is the clouds before the moon, as they say. So more than just theory or religious terminology, this is actually important to think about our relationship to the inner refuge of Buddha. Do we believe it? Do we experience it? Then the inner refuge of Dharma. The teachings start as some kind of external thing. They start as principles and ideas and things that maybe sound interesting, maybe sound offensive. But more and more, our life is the Dharma. All of it is evident. We can give voice to the teachings in our own personal way. And some of you who've done koan study or want to do koan study, that's one of the things that it's about. It's how do you give expression to the teachings in your very own personal way, not through someone else's words. Because if you're Buddha nature, you don't need the Buddha's words or anyone else's words. You have your own way of giving expression. All the teachings flow from your own heart. It's all coming from your mind. All of it. Then we have the inner refuge of Sangha. So if we were like really fixated on the outer level, like Buddhism as cool club, I'm not sure anymore whether Buddhism is a cool club. I think sometimes it's seen as a cool club. Like the religion that's okay. It'll change. Right? It's sort of a fashion thing. It depends on... I think Keanu Reeves is a Buddhist. That's definitely makes it the cool religion. Keanu is so nice. Have you seen on Instagram sometimes the like nice Keanu posts where he's like having a dinner with like some beautiful person and some annoying child comes up and he always stops what he's doing and is like, I will sign your cast. Keanu is definitely a Buddha. So we have a cool club, but the inner level of refuge is getting over any fixation on the club. The more inner Buddha and Dharma, the wider our sense of belonging. the wider our love for beings, the wider circle of those we can learn from. It doesn't exclude being rooted in a spiritual community. It doesn't exclude that we may live in a temple or spend most of our time with people who are Buddhists. But as we realize inner Sangha, there is no longer a sense of inside and outside to our sense of who's a Buddha. Another way of saying it is, when you recognize what your mind is, you simultaneously know what everyone else's mind is. That's part of what it means to free all beings. You free all beings from any limited, diminished view of what they are because you've done that for yourself. And your mind and everyone else's mind, can they be different? I suppose we never know. People often believe they have an especially messed up mind. I hear that very often. I'm especially messed up. Yeah, but I'm especially confused or judgy or depressed or whatever. But maybe not. So inner Sangha is this growing sense of kinship. In a traditional way that they say it in the teaching is that you transcend foes and enemies. Excuse me, you transcend friend and foe. That always rubbed me the wrong way that you would transcend friends. I get transcending foes. I don't really get why they would say you transcend friends. I would say it's a growing sense of who is friend. More capacity, even someone who maybe doesn't like us. In our hearts, we have more ability to regard as friend. Someone who is touching into inner Sangha, I believe, is not dogmatic about religious teachings. They can draw very freely from different sources. Because there's not this inside-outside thing of, wait, that's not Buddhist. There's a time for that, for being clear on the teaching. But this inclusiveness makes room for a lot. So then we come to the indestructible, sometimes called the secret level. In the context of this practice here, the elixir of bodhicitta, we could call it the immediate level. Because here's the thing. When you sit down, when you're doing practice, Buddhism doesn't matter at all. It doesn't matter at all. Zero. Zip. There's no Buddhism at that moment. There's no Sangha at that moment. There's not even the Dharma at that moment. There's just that moment. We're putting that all aside. The actual moment of practice is a moment of naked immediacy. Of naked immediacy. But that naked immediacy has particular qualities that are always true. That we can recognize to be always true. So in this this formula says, I take refuge in this very mind and moment as the indivisible three kayas. So the three kayas, kaya means body or expanse. It can be translated differently. At a certain point in the unfolding of the Mahayana tradition, people wanted to try to describe the Buddha's realization a little bit more explicitly. And they described it as the three kayas, Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, Nirmanakaya. these terms that I list in this refuge are different terminologies for these kayas, these aspects of this very mind and moment, viewed not through our discriminating preferential labeling mind, but viewed, I could say, through awareness. In a way, here's where a real Zen teacher just stops. You know, Robert Aiken Roshi, he said, if you're ever with a Zen teacher and they start explaining something like emptiness, you should get up and leave the room. I love that, and he's right. But I don't have such integrity. So the first of the kayas is open purity. This means two things. That the Buddha nature, the true nature of awareness, does not contract, does not attach, is not involved in a reaching or avoiding way ever. It's immutably open. Just like the moon is immutably the moon, whether we can see the whole thing or not, whether there's clouds or not. I was talking earlier in our sitting about we can distinguish about the depth of our abiding, but because through this metric, ordinary mind has preference. It wants to feel this and it would rather avoid that. It thinks these sounds are pretty and these are not. It gets bored because it says that might be more interesting. This is not so interesting. But open purity, Dharmakaya, is like space. Purity is an interesting term, and it's debatable whether it's helpful for Dharma practitioners because it conjures up Judeo-Christian notions of purity, where there are things that are impure and there are other things that are pure and holy. This purity means that as this open awakeness, everything is suffused with isness evenly. One aspect of experience is not more pure than another. One aspect is not more true than another, but it's fully suffused, just like if you dip a cloth into water all the way, it's fully and evenly suffused. Faith in this means that nothing that arises is a mistake. Nothing that arises is outside of Buddha nature. From your knee pain to your agony about the loss of your whoever, none of that is outside of the Dharma. As I often say, ordinary minds simply can't do that. It's always ranking experience. It's always saying, well, I don't know about this. I had a better meditation last week. It's always passing judgment. It's ranking through comparison. Open purity is all good. Another way to say it, it's all good. We enact that. This is the interesting thing. We make this real. We embody it through letting go of the discriminating mind. Because if there's only ever judging, we can't know open purity. After we really know open purity, even the judging mind can come, and it's purely the judging mind. Dharmakaya is equivalent with Buddha. The second refuge on this immediate level, I call untamable playful energy. As an expression of this space, things are arising, and they are always arising. They arise mentally, they arise physically, they arise on every dimension of experience, they're arising. If we embody this openness, two things start to become clear to us. Things are not substantial, they're closer to energies. I was using the word a dream earlier. Everything that's arising is more like, it's like life is more like watercolor. There's a lack of density. There is a weightlessness. There is a freedom. Within openness, life energy dances, and it dances as every aspect of this moment. And it's untamable. You can have moments of quiescence for sure. Your mind can become more and more simple for sure. But ultimately, energy will arise. Movement and openness, movement and stillness come together. And it's like a play. Then the third refuge, all suffusing natural presence. This means there's this openness, there's things happening within this openness that aren't things, and awareness is already there. Awareness is already the nature of each of these textures. Just like I say these words and there's no moment when you have to make any effort to hear. Or you turn your head and you look and it takes no effort at all for there to be a form. There's awareness of forms. There's awareness of sounds. The belief that we are inside there as a subject encountering objects externally keeps us in the feeling sense of separation. A way to describe this is that we tend to feel that I'm inside of this body and out of my portholes, consciousness goes, or into my portholes, experience comes. And that's what's meant by duality. This is saying everything is already suffused with the Buddha nature. It's one. And one thing this means is that we can actually relax. We can go from doing meditation to being meditation to being meditated. And maybe even forget that. So I hope that there's something clarifying about talking about refuge. I specifically hope the immediate refuges serve to empower the practice to not be coming from a place of spiritual poverty. That I'm going to try hard and do something to my brain and get something good.